round in circles in the veil. "It's a treason charge," Cyril said quietly. "If I release you before you face the tribunal, it's a death sentence for me as well, to say nothing of the fact that any irregularity would practically guarantee your conviction." Tarvi made a clicking sound with his teeth. "There's always..." Cyril cut him off with a wave of his hand and exhaled through his nose. "All right," he said quietly. "This has gone badly, but it could have been worse. The next thing to focus on is making sure the Legion's supply lines are kept secure. Then we'll turn some attention to your trial defense."
Tarvi shook his head. "We don't have time. There's too much at stake."
"Yes," Cyril responded rather sharply. "But you've been outmaneuvered. You're of no use to the Crown now."
"I could be," Tarvi said quietly. "Let me arrange something. None of the blame will come to you."
Cyril began shaking his head. "Scipio, I am a soldier and a servant of the Crown. I always have been. And at this moment the Crown's law says that you are to remain in custody until a tribunal can be assembled. We've worked well together the past 2 years. We know one another. We've each earned a certain amount of the other's trust."
He gave Isana a quite pointed glance and looked back at Tarvi.
"But by now you ought to know where I draw the line."
Tarvi grimaced. Disappointment and a nauseating sense of dread began to spill through even his formidable discipline.
"I do," he said quietly. "Then you ought to know that I'm not going to play along with some kind of escape fiction." He grimaced. "I can't fight any more, but I'm tired of everyone making light of the laws of the realm, abusing them like Arnas did. I can't make them stop, but it doesn't mean I'm going to participate in it. I'll be glad to help you, by every legal means at my disposal."
"If you had an order from the Crown," Tarvi said quietly, "you could do it."
"But I don't," Cyril said.
Isana's heart suddenly pounded very hard in her chest. Tarvi met Cyril's eyes and said quietly,
"You do now."
Stars flared across Isana's vision, and she gripped the arms of her chair as hard as she could.
Cyril frowned at Tarvi and said, "What?"
Tarvi gave Cyril half of a smile.
"Come now, Cyril. You've known since the day you met me that my name wasn't Rufus Scipio."
Cyril's frown deepened.
"Yes. I surmised that you were one of the Crown's cursors, given the way the Battle of Elenarch turned out, and what you've done since."
"And I am," Tarvi said quietly. "But there's more.
You've heard rumors about me by now. You've heard rumors about my singulare, Araris."
Tarvi paused for a moment.
"The Araris. Araris Valerian."
Cyril stared at Tarvi, his lips parted slightly.
"That's why I asked her to be here today," Tarvi said, gesturing toward Isana. "Why I've spoken so openly in front of her."
Tarvi turned to her, and Isana could feel his fear and frustration and anger and something else, something deep and powerful and terrifying for which there was no word. It was a kind of wonder, she thought dazedly, a kind of elation, and at the same time it was a horror and dread. Isana had felt it before, long ago. Tears blinded her as more memories came back to sudden vivid life. "Oh, Septimus, I miss you so much, and in this moment you would be so proud."
She turned her face to Sir Cyril, blinking until the tears fell. The older man simply gaped at Tarvi, his mouth still open, his eyes wide. Disbelief blended wildly with comprehension, well-aged anxiety with sudden hope. His hands closed into fists, and his voice shook as he spoke.
"What," he whispered, "is your name?"
Tarvi rose, slowly lifting his chin.
"My name,"
he said quietly, is Gaius Octavian. He stepped forward and dropped to one knee, meeting Cyril eye to eye. Sir Cyril, I trust you. That's why I've just put my life, he nodded to Asana, and my mother's, into your hands. Cyril stared at Tavi, his face bloodless. His mouth worked a couple of times, then he turned to Isana.
Your mother?
Isana swallowed. Now she understood why Tavi had asked her here. To support him. She was, after all, very nearly the only one alive who could. A panicked voice within told her to deny it. Without her corroboration, Tavi's story would sound like a wild, desperate, and implausible lie. She had to hide him. She had to protect him. She had to... Isana pressed against that panicked voice, against her own terror. It was time to stop lying. To stop hiding. Without a word, she reached for the slender chain she'd worn around her neck ever since she had left the Calderon Valley for Alera Imperia years before. She unfastened the clasp and drew it from where it lay hidden beneath her gown. The elegant silver ring, complete with its gem of scarlet and azure, seamlessly joined down its center, caught the light and glittered brightly, throwing flickers of colored fire upon the top of Cyril's desk. Isana set it there gently and folded her hands in her lap. "Given me by my husband, Princeps Gaius Septimus," Isana said quietly, "upon our wedding, some 10 months before his death." She rose to stand behind Tavi, facing Cyril, and lifted her own chin. "This is our son, Octavian. He was born the night of the first Battle of Calderon, the same night his father died." Cyril stared at her, then at the ring. He reached out to pick it up, his hands shaking visibly. "The mark of his signet dagger is carved on the inside, beneath the stones," Isana said quietly. "He left me the dagger as well. It's in a trunk in my room." The ring tumbled from Sir Cyril's fingertips, back to the top of the desk. Cyril shook his head, stammering, "How can this be?" Tavi, still on his knee, turned back to look up at Isana. For a second, she saw him again. The boy she had watched over, fed, cared for, loved, and lied to. Great Furies help her, had there been more she could have done to hide him, she would have. Araris had been right. He deserved the truth. She met her son's eyes. "What very few know," Isana said, careful to keep her voice steady, her words clear, "is that Septimus had twice been attacked by assassins in the 2 years prior to his death. His efforts to discover their employer were unsuccessful. When he took the Crown Legion to put down the rebellion at the Battle of Seven Hills, another assassin wounded him so badly the night after the battle that even with his own skills at healing, Septimus barely survived. That was why the First Lord sent the Crown Legion off to the farthest reaches of the realm, to the Calderon Valley. Officially it was to rest and recover from the losses sustained at Seven Hills. Only his Singulares and Sextus knew it was to give Septimus a chance to recover in relative privacy." She grimaced. "Septimus wanted to return to Alera Imperia and dare them to come after him again, to catch whoever was behind it. But Sextus ordered him to Calderon. Septimus obeyed, but he wasn't content simply to rest and recover. He began sending out men he trusted to search for answers of his own. And how could she possibly speak of 1,000 memories, of the words between them, of how Septimus had become her entire world? How could she convey what it had meant to touch his hand, to listen to his voice, to feel his heart beating against her as he slept? How could she make them know what it had felt like for an awkward Holder girl to fall in love with a man so strong and gentle and kind?" "We met there," she said in a whisper. "We fell in love. We married. Tavi stared up at her, and his expression was no longer a careful mask. He looked up at her the way any hungry child had ever looked up to his mother. He had been starving. For his whole life he had been starving for the truth, and only now was he about to be sated. "Septimus learned of a plot against him," she continued. "Several of the other young men of his generation, he wasn't sure who, had formed a cabal swearing to remove him and displace the House of Gaius from the throne." She swallowed. "I think he suspected that the Marat invasion was engineered by this group of men. And it is my belief that they struck at him there during the battle." Isana's tears blurred the room once more. "They killed him." She swallowed and forced herself to continue. "Septimus had sent me from the camp, accompanied by my young sister, Alia, with Araris as my singulare, just before the Marat arrived. But I was heavy with child, and I began delivery before we could go more than a few miles. We hid in a cave. It was a difficult birthing. Alia helped me, but died of an arrow wound she'd gotten. That's where Octavian was born. In a cave. While his father fought invaders and traitors and died so that others would have a chance to live." Tavi's eyes suddenly shone. His expression didn't change, though the tears began to fall freely. "I was alone," Isana said quietly, "but for Araris. And he could not protect Octavian from those who had murdered his father. Neither could Sextus. He hadn't protected his own son, and I would not chance mine upon his remorse." She felt her back straighten. "So I hid Octavian away. Araris marked his own face with the coward's brand, knowing no one would ever look for Araris Valerian beneath it, and sold himself into slavery. I purchased him, and he helped me watch over Tavi in my brother's steadhold." She reached out and touched his hair with one hand. "We told no one. Not even Octavian. There was no other way to keep him safe." She met her son's eyes and felt his bitterness, his lifelong ache, and his newly born fear. She felt his rage. And beneath all of it, threaded and braided with every emotion, was his love. Simple, strong, tarnished perhaps, but not broken. Her son still loved her. He was angry and afraid of the future, and broken with sadness about the loss of a father he'd never known, even if he did not himself realize it yet. Though his heart was wounded, the wounds could heal. They would pass in time. His love would not. Isana crouched, bowed her head, and laid her forehead gently against Tavi's. He leaned into her, and his hands suddenly found hers, squeezing tight. They shared tears for a moment, tears of loss and regret and repentance. Isana whispered, too quietly for Cyril to hear, "I'm so sorry. Your father would have been so proud of you, my Tavi." Her son's shoulders twitched, and his breath caught in his throat for a second, before he bowed his head and leaned more against her. She put her arms around him in a sudden, fiercely tight embrace. He wept silently, his body jerking several times. Isana held him and closed her eyes. She opened them again when she felt Cyril's pain. He stood from the desk, wincing as the weight went onto his maimed leg, and limped steadily around it. Wordlessly, he offered the ring and its chain back to Isana. "Thank you," she whispered.
"You should hide it, my lady," he murmured back, "until the time is right."
Then he shifted position and dropped painfully to one knee. Isana touched Tavi's shoulder. He looked up to meet Sir Cyril's gaze. Cyril bowed his head deeply.
"Your Highness," he murmured, "how may I serve the crown?"
Chapter 21. Tavi thought it somewhat ironic that the bunk in his cell was considerably more comfortable than his own. Granted, it had hardly been used during the 2 years since it had been built. The occasional drunken or brawling legionare had cooled his heels within, but that had been an infrequent event. In general, Tavi had followed Cyril's example of trusting his centurions to maintain discipline rather than meddling in it himself. And as a result, the only legionaries to see the inside of the cell had been those luckless or stupid enough to screw up in front of their captain's eyes. Of course, he wasn't their captain any more. He probably never would be again. That bothered him more than he thought it would, especially since it was a position that had been thrust upon him by necessity in the first place. He'd only been here at the Elenarch for 2 years, but in that time it had become some place familiar to him. It hadn't been a happy time. Too many people had been hurt or killed for that. It had, however, been an important time. There had been joy to balance the sorrow, laughter to counter the tears. He had worked hard and won respect, as well as shed blood. He had made friends, too, of those who had fought beside him. It had become his home. That was over now. He lay in his bunk, staring up at the stone ceiling. He missed his room in the command building. He missed the bustle of the Legion's routine. There were times when he missed Bernard Holt. Isana Holt, he corrected himself. Only it probably wouldn't be that for very much longer either. Declaring himself to Sir Cyril had changed all of that. Learning the truth had changed it. He tried to sort through his thoughts and feelings on the matter, but it was a hopeless tangle. Isana was his mother. His father had been murdered, and his enemies, presumably, were still at liberty. Should he feel rage at whoever had taken his father from him? It seemed to him that he should, but he hadn't felt it yet. In stories, a young man in his position should be making oaths of vengeance and setting out with grim determination to punish his father's killers. Instead, he just felt numb. Too much had happened too quickly. Isana's emotions, as she told him about his father, had been exquisitely painful. He'd drunk them down like a man dying of thirst despite that, but there was no denying that the experience had shaken him severely. Perhaps this oddly peaceful lack of emotions was simply the result of overexposure, like the ringing in his ears during the silence after the roar of battle. He'd felt his mother's grief and regret and anxiety as distinctly as if they had been his own. He had never felt another's emotions so clearly before, not even Kitai's. He wondered why his senses had seemed so much more adept when it came to Isana. Before, he had only imagined her good intentions, her fears, her motivations in lying to him and everyone else for all those years. Now, he knew. He knew that she had acted as she had out of love and desperation, taking the only measures she could to protect him. He knew how deeply she had loved Septimus, and how viciously his death had wounded her. He knew how much she loved him. When she finally talked to him about it, she had told him the truth, complete and open, not only with her words, but with the heart and mind beneath them. He knew it. There was absolutely no room for doubt. She would never apologize for what she had done. Her words had been an apology for the pain he'd undergone over those years, regret for the necessities she had been forced to, but she would never apologize for doing them. Tavi knew that now. She had done what she thought was right and necessary. He could either respect that or hold it against her for the rest of his life. He rubbed at his aching head. He was tired. Holding grudges took far too much energy, energy he would need for more immediate endeavors. The past had lain quietly for more than 20 years. It could keep a little longer. The future was all one vast, terrible vagary. It could wait. It always did. Lives were at stake, here and now. Tavi ground his teeth in frustration and glared at the door of iron bars. It wasn't really an obstacle. He could probably summon up enough strength to rip the door out of the wall, hinges and all. The idea had a certain primal appeal, but it seemed a little excessive. It wouldn't take more than a moment or two to pick the lock, which would make for a better, quieter escape in any case. The problem was that the door wasn't his obstacle. The law was. Tavi could have ordered Cyril to release him, but it would have required him to violate a number of laws, and that could have repercussions for him in the long run. It was by no means guaranteed that simply being Gaius Sextus's blood heir would be sufficient actually to give him the power of a princeps with which to protect Cyril from such actions. There was no guarantee that Gaius would accept him, and even if he did, there was no guarantee that the house of Gaius would continue holding the crown. He hadn't dared to ask Cyril for much, for his own sake. He hadn't told Cyril anything of his plans. He hadn't asked for any cooperation of any kind, in fact. If things went bad, and Cyril was questioned by a truth-finder later, he would honestly be able to say that he hadn't helped Tavi escape, and had no idea where he was going or what he was doing.
Where the crows was Erin?
Waiting for dark, of course. From inside the cell, Tavi had no way of guessing where the sun was. He stretched, sighed, and settled in to try to sleep. Many soldiers learned how to take immediate sleep during any free moment, but officers rarely had any such time to spare, and Tavi hadn't been able to pick up the trick of it. He lay with his thoughts for 2 hours, waiting for the sun to go down, until he finally managed to begin to drift off to sleep. Naturally, that was when Erin came. Footsteps approached the cell door, and Tavi sat up and swung his feet off the bunk. By the time they'd hit the stone floor, the cell door rattled and opened, and the sandy-haired little cursor stood in the doorway, dressed in simple and well-made travelling clothes, a bundle of clothing under one arm. He tossed it to Tavi. Tavi lost no time shedding his uniform and donning the unremarkable civilian's clothing. "Any problems?"
"Not yet," Erin said.
He shook a rather large, rather heavy-looking purse at his side. It jingled.
"I wouldn't have thought Cyril had this kind of money."
"Merchant family. They have a lot of connections in the Senate."
Tavi finished dressing, paused for a moment to consider, and then laid his uniform clothes out on the bunk, positioned as they would be if he had been sleeping in them. "There." Erin snorted. "That ought to make for an interesting rumor or two." Tavi grinned.
"Can't hurt. What about the guard?"
Erin tapped the purse again.
"Two of the girls who used to work for Mistress Simnea have him pretty thoroughly distracted. We could smash our way through the wall with mining picks and he wouldn't notice."
Tavi let out a small sigh of relief. "Good. I didn't want anyone to get hurt over this."
"The night is young," Erin said.
Once Tavi was dressed, Erin tossed him a long dark cloak with a deep hood, similar to his own. They pulled the hoods up and left the cell. Erin locked it behind them. They left the command building by the back door and hurried away through the darkened streets.
"How long before the wind coach arrives?" Tavi asked.
Erin grimaced.
"There's a problem."
Tavi arched an eyebrow.
"Windcrafters were expensive and hard to find even before the war," Erin said. "Legions all over Alera have been offering incentives to recruit more of them. All the flyers who haven't gone into the legions are overworked already, even with their prices raised through the roof."
"I don't care what it costs. We need a coach."
"We aren't getting one," Erin said. "We're in the middle of nowhere. None of the coaches are willing to fly all the way out to a war zone with empty seats."
"Crows,"
Tavi spat.
"Where are we headed?"
"The docks," Erin replied. "The others are waiting there."
Tavi stopped and blinked at Erin.
"A ship? We'll have to sail halfway around the coast to get to the Gaul."
Erin shrugged.
"Beggars and choosers. It will take even longer to walk it."
Tavi sighed. They walked down one of the many wooden staircases that led down the riverbank to the extensive docks that lined both sides of the river. Taverns and warehouses lined the waterside, and if the legions had departed, the traders and rivermen hadn't. The docks were as busy as any other night, and Tavi and Erin had no trouble blending in. Erin led them to one of the larger docks, and out along it to its lone occupant, a lean and ill-favoured ship, conspicuous for its lack of fury lamps, and passers-by. No one but themselves seemed willing to pace down its wooden length, and Tavi was just as glad. In the darkness, Tavi could just barely make out the letters on the ship's prow, proclaiming it the Slive. Several cloaked figures waited at the bottom of the gangplank, and one of them broke away from the others to walk toward Tavi. "Challa," Kitai said quietly, and embraced him. "I missed you. You are well?" Tavi kissed her hair. "I'm fine." His mother was close behind Kitai. She gave him a smile and an uncertain nod. Tavi released the Marat woman and went to Isana, hugging her. Tavi felt a sudden sense of relief surge through her. She hugged him back, hard.
"We'll have some time. We'll talk," he said quietly.
She nodded, not speaking, and they broke the embrace. Araris stepped forward from the shadows and nodded to Tavi. He offered Tavi his sword belt, and Tavi accepted it gratefully, glad to feel the familiar weight of the weapon once more at his side. Araris, his eyes in constant motion, moved silently to stand behind Tavi, watching the length of the dock between them and the shore. "Captain," Aaron called quietly. "We're ready." A man appeared at the head of the gangplank and walked quietly down it. He was a little taller than average and lean, and wore a long blade at his hip. He stepped onto the dock and stopped when he was standing just out of reach of Tavi's gladius, but within the range of his own weapon. He had a flat, cool mask of a face, and the guarded, calculating eyes of a professional swordsman. "This is Captain Deimos," Aaron said. "He was the man who got me back to Alera in time to warn you of the Khanim fleet." Deimos nodded to Tavi.
"Who are you?"
"Rufus Scipio," Tavi replied. Deimos blinked once and shrugged.
"All right. Aaron here tells me you have a job."
"I need passage to the capital and back. I need to move some goods discreetly. Can you do it?" Deimos shrugged.
"Probably, if the price is right."
"Let's talk price then," Tavi said.
"I don't haggle," Deimos replied. "You pay it, or you find someone else."
Tavi studied the man quietly for a moment, then he shrugged.
"How much?"
500 eagles, Deimos replied. "That's just the transport fee. The bribes are an extra expense, so is the food. You pay me half up front, half on completion."
Tavi glanced aside at Aaron, who nodded once.
"Done," Tavi said.
Deimos looked between the two of them, then at the others.
"Get this straight. You might be hiring me, but I'm the captain on my ship. I don't take orders. I give them. If I give you an order, I expect you to obey it, or you'll swim the rest of the way."
"I understand," Tavi said.
"Still want to do business?"
Tavi held out his hand to Aaron. The cursor slapped the heavy purse into it. Tavi tossed the purse to Deimos, who plucked it out of the air with a lazy movement of his arm. Deimos bounced the purse on his palm once and nodded. His face twitched with an expression that, if it had not been murdered in its birth, might have grown into a smile.
"Very well, sir. Welcome aboard the Slive. We'll cast off in half an hour."
He turned and went back up onto his ship and started calling out commands. Men began moving around the deck, readying ropes and sails. Tavi grimaced at the ship.
"Aaron."
The young cursor nodded and raised his hand, while a frown of concentration came over his face. The air pressed suddenly against Tavi's ears, more uncomfortable than painful.
"All right," Aaron said. "That's as much as I can do."
Tavi nodded. "How long will it take us to get there by ship?"
3 weeks, give or take," Aaron said quietly.
"Too long," Tavi said.
"I don't think you thought this through very well," Aaron said. "Let's say we had a coach right now. What did you plan on doing? Telling them to fly up to the Grey Tower, wait until you got back with a 9-foot-tall furry prisoner, then to come back here? Every night heiress who can get off the ground will come after the coach to get him back."
"What?" Kitai demanded.
"What?"
Isana said, alarmed. Araris made a choking noise, but he didn't turn around. Tavi grimaced.
"We couldn't outrun them on horseback either."
"Right," Aaron said. If only we knew some way to sneak a high-profile Carne out of the capital without being caught.
Tavi gave him a sidelong glance. Aaron's face was creased into a grin. Tavi frowned for a moment, then struck his own forehead lightly with the heel of his hand.
It's already been done. Someone managed to slip Saul out of the capital and all the way back to the Carnim homelands.
Exactly, Aaron said.
And you found out how they did it?
Aaron smirked.
Better. I found out who.
Tavi looked up at the ship.
I see.
Alaren, Kitai said. Perhaps it would be wise to tell all of us what we are doing.
Tavi chewed on his lip for a moment, then nodded.
We're going to Alara Imperia. We're going to break Ambassador Varg out of the Grey Tower, smuggle him back to Nasorg, and exchange him as a token of good faith for a cessation of hostilities in the Vale.
Araris made another choking sound. Kitai nodded.
Isana folded her arms beneath her cloak.
Is that altogether wise?
Kitai rolled her eyes.
Why should he start now? The security has been tightened there, Aaron said. I read a report on it somewhere 3 or 4 years ago.
I know, Tavi said. I wrote it. Gaius had it redesigned based on some of my recommendations.
Aaron pursed his lips thoughtfully.
Oh, that does raise some interesting possibilities, then.
Tavi nodded.
But I need each of you there. That's why I've asked you along.
That, Kitai said, is the least unwise thing you have said tonight.
She peered up at the slive, her eyes tracing the dim shapes of the ropes, and the sailors moving nimbly among them.
I have never been on a ship.
Nor have I, Tavi said.
Aaron, what—
Down!
Barked Araris, even as his blade cleared its sheath.
He swept it in a single smooth cut, and there was a snapping sound as it cleaved an arrow streaking down the length of the dock.
Tavi crouched as Araris shattered 2 more arrows with as many sweeps of his blade and looked around them wildly. There were figures out there at the riverbank end of the dock, crouching in thick shadow.
The ship! Tavi snapped. Everyone aboard! Move!
Another arrow hissed, and Kitai let out a breathless cry. Tavi felt a sudden vague shock of pain run through the left side of his body. The Marat girl staggered.
Go, go!
Shouted Araris. Tavi seized Kitai, tossed her unceremoniously over a shoulder, and dashed up the gangplank. Isana followed him, but stumbled. Aaron was there at once, supporting her. Tavi made the deck of the ship and hurried to get out of sight of the archer's shooting position. Araris came up the gangplank last, sword still in hand. Deimos took one look, saw what was happening, and began barking orders to cast off. His crew, evidently men who were familiar with the procedures for precipitous departures, leapt into action, and within a minute the ship was being warped away from the dock and out into the slow current of the Tiber.
Light! Tavi called, laying Kitai down on the deck. I need a light here!
Deimos appeared a few moments later, bearing a covered lantern. He handed it to Tavi without a word, and went back to calling orders. Tavi opened the lantern and found a plain candle burning inside. It gave him enough light to see Kitai's injury. The arrow had pierced her left arm, on an angle through the biceps muscle. Her teeth were clenched, though there was more outrage than pain in her face.
"Doesn't look bad," Tavi said.
Isana knelt beside him and examined the Marat girl's wound.
The head isn't poisoned or barbed, but it's sharp. It's close to the artery. If we try to draw it back through, we could open it ourselves.
Tavi nodded.
Break the arrow?
Let me get a proper tub of water first, Isana said. It's possible that the arrow itself is staunching the wound. I can make sure it isn't a problem.
Araris? Tavi asked. I'll find a tub. The Singulare said, sheathing his weapon.
Tavi leaned down and kissed Kitai's hair again.
Give us just a minute, he said quietly. Then we'll get it out of you.
Kitai set her jaw, nodded once, and closed her eyes. Aaron leaned down and picked up the lantern.
He frowned and moved it.
There. Do you see?
Tavi looked up to where the candle's light fell upon the fletching of the arrow that had wounded Kitai. The feathers were black, green, brown, with a black band at their base. He'd seen them before, at close quarters in the senator's wind coach.
"Iris the Hawk," Tavi said quietly. "Good thing Deimos didn't have any lights up," Aaron murmured. "Even shooting in the dark, she hit one of us."
Tavi made sure the light of the little lantern was blocked from the docks behind them, then rose, staring back at the dock they'd just departed. A slender figure, sword in hand, stood at the end of the dock, barely visible in the light of the fury lamps on the boardwalk. Phrygia Navaris. Several others came to stand beside her, the rest of Arnas's singulares. Tavi fancied he could feel Navaris's serpentine hatred drifting over the water.
"It would seem," Aaron said, "that someone doesn't want you making this trip."
"Then someone," Tavi replied, "is going to be disappointed."
Chapter 22 Amara crouched beside Bernard in the wavering light of his woodcrafting as another patrol wound slowly through the forest and away from them. As the last of them went out of sight, she murmured,
"Have I mentioned how attractive you've been the last several days?"
Bernard moved suddenly, and his hand clamped gently over her mouth. He let out a soft breath that nonetheless conveyed a warning, and Amara fell silent. The forest sighed around them, the thickening leaves rustling in a low breeze. She saw nothing, heard nothing. She turned to Bernard, her face set in a question. He touched a finger to his lips. Then, his eyes unfocused, he raised his bow. Amara stared at him, hardly daring to move. Bernard glanced down at the ground beneath him, and she saw his face grow intent. His lips moved. The earth suddenly rippled out from him in a circle, not a violent upheaval, but a single rippling pulse, as if someone had struck the ground with a large hammer. Bits of dust and old leaves leapt up from the ground in a low shower. Not 20 feet in front of them, some of the bracken struck against something solid but unseen. In the same instant, Bernard's bow bent and thrummed. There was an immediate ugly sound of impact, and then a man appeared, dressed in leathers and bearing a bow of his own. Bernard's broad-headed, thick-shafted arrow protruded at an angle from the man's back. Bernard moved, a single bound that took him most of the way to the other man, and Amara could see that he had dropped his bow and drawn his hunting knife from the sheath at his side. The other man straightened, turning, but before he could cry out or bring his own weapon to bear, Bernard was on his back and bore him to the ground. Amara watched as, with brutal efficiency, Bernard reached around with his knife and cut his throat. Bernard held the other man down, grinding his face into the dirt until his struggles ceased half a minute later. Then he straightened slowly, his head up, eyes focused in the direction the rest of the patrol had gone. After another full minute had passed, Bernard turned to Amara and nodded once, beckoning. Amara turned behind her.
"Sire."
Gaius came out of the woods behind them, moving more easily than he had since the first days of their journey, though he still carried the walking staff. The First Lord moved up to stand beside Bernard and looked down at the body. He touched the fallen man's powerful bow with the end of his staff.
"A knight flora," the First Lord said quietly. "Like you."
"Never served as a knight, sire,"
Bernard said, shaking his head.
"Centurion in the auxiliary cohort."
Gaius glanced at him.
But obviously you had the skill for it."
Bernard shrugged.
"Knights in my legion seemed a little full of themselves, sire. Didn't feel like spending all my time with them."
Amara walked up to stand beside her husband, still somewhat shocked at the suddenness of what had happened. She had seen violence before, but she had never seen Bernard engaged in it against another man. She knew he had been a soldier in his past, but for some reason she had never pictured him killing in such a way. For a moment, His idle chat with the First Lord seemed wildly inappropriate, but only until she saw the faintly sickened expression in his eyes. She touched his elbow. "Are you all right?" she asked. He nodded without speaking. Then he looked at his bloodied knife, knelt down, and wiped it clean on the man's clothing. When he rose, his voice was rough.
"He'd heard us. Or sensed us, somehow. I could tell he had stopped right about there."
Gaius grimaced.
"You had little choice, then. Even if he hadn't seen through your veil, he'd have circled back and picked up our trail."
Bernard nodded.
"And the way he was trailing their normal patrol means that he was expecting to catch us moving after they had passed."
He looked up and met Amara's gaze for no more than a second.
"They know we're out here, and that we've got some woodcraft on our side, if they spared someone like him to look for us."
"How long before they notice he's missing?" Amara asked. Bernard took a deep breath and nodded to himself.
"As long as possible."
He turned to the body and rapidly went through the man's pockets and a small belt pouch. He discarded everything he found, shook his head, then touched the ground with his fingertips, murmuring under his breath. The earth quivered, and then the body began sinking into it, as if into very soft mud. Within a minute it was gone from sight altogether, leaving nothing but an oblong, rounded patch of bare earth in its wake. At Bernard's direction, Amara and Gaius helped him scatter more of the detritus of the forest floor over the bare patch, and he went over it himself once they were done, until he was satisfied that they had concealed it.
"All right," he said afterward. "A man like this, if he'd found our trail, might well take off and follow it alone for a time. Even if the patrol noticed he was gone within the hour, they might not think anything of it if he doesn't show up until the end of the day."
Amara nodded. "It makes sense. What do we do about it?"
"We make better pace," Bernard said. "As fast as we can for as long as we can. I can cover our trail pretty well for an hour, maybe two. The farther we get before we start leaving tracks again, the longer it will take them to find our trail using a standard search pattern."
"We've most of the distance still ahead," Amara said. "A couple of hours, even a full day's lead, won't be enough. They'll catch up long before we get to Kalare."
"We don't have to beat them to Kalare," Bernard replied. "We just have to beat them to the swamps. No one's going to be able to track us through that."
He looked up at Gaius.
"We've got to pick up the pace, sire."
Gaius nodded, his expression sober.
"I'll manage, Count."
Bernard turned to Amara.
"I've got to walk behind us to hide our trail. It's going to take much of my attention. Do you think you've learned enough to hold a straight course?"
Amara swallowed. Over the week they'd been traveling, Bernard had been improving upon her rather rudimentary field craft as they marched, and in camp at night. She would never have believed how difficult something as simple as traveling in a straight line could be once one was surrounded by miles and miles of forest. It all looked the same. The sun was often hidden by the canopy of leaves and branches, assuming it was a sunny day in the first place, and that old chestnut about moss growing on the north side of the trees was entirely unreliable. As it turned out, there was a great deal more simple know-how than fury crafting involved in navigating overland. That was to be expected, she supposed. The vast majority of Alarans lived in steadholts in the countryside, and few of them possessed anywhere near the talent Bernard did in even one form of fury crafting, much less two. Amara had formed a habit of learning new skills, thanks to her cursor training, but the lessons had served mostly to make her acutely aware of how much she didn't know. She had little choice, though. There were only three of them. And even if Gaius had the necessary skill, which she doubted, he would have difficulty enough simply holding the pace. "I've had a good teacher," she said quietly, nodding. Bernard gave her a small smile.
"All right. Find your points of reference, and let's turn a bit more to the east."
Amara took a deep breath and returned his smile with one she hoped did not look as nervous as she felt. Then she lined up a tree behind her with one in front of her in the direction they wanted to move, and led the way. They were able to maintain a surprisingly good pace over the next hour. Amara broke into a relaxed lope whenever the ground was smooth enough to warrant it. Though Gaius's face grew lined with discomfort, and though he still favored his leg, he was able to keep up. Bernard followed along several yards behind them, frowning down at the ground, and only occasionally looking around him. After that, though, their pace began to suffer, and more because of Bernard than the First Lord. The woodsman's jaw had locked into a stubborn clench, and he shambled along with heavy feet, like a man bearing an increasingly heavy burden. Gaius noticed Bernard's discomfort, and frowned at Amara. She grimaced, just as worried as the First Lord, but she knew what Bernard would say if she suggested they rest. Amara shook her head in a negative and kept going at the best pace she thought they could sustain. By the time the light began to slant steeply through the forest and darken into shafts of sunset amber, Bernard was barely managing to keep himself moving forward. Amara began looking for some place out of sight where they could rest, and found it in a broad ditch where a stream had evidently shifted its bed. Gaius slipped down into it with a grunt of discomfort, but Bernard was shaking with fatigue when he tried to climb down and nearly toppled headfirst into the ditch. Amara managed to steady him, and he promptly sat down on the ground, leaned his back against the side of the ditch, and dropped his head forward in exhausted sleep.
"How far did we come, do you think?" Gaius asked quietly.
The First Lord was vigorously rubbing his bad leg. Amara saw it jerking and twitching in a cramp and winced in sympathy. "Since he began covering our trail? Perhaps 8 or 9 miles? It's excellent time, considering."
Gaius grimaced. "Nothing like a nice walk to make one appreciate flying, eh?"
"True enough, sire." She moved to him and withdrew her flask from her pack. She offered it to the First Lord, and Gaius accepted it with a nod of thanks and drank thirstily.
"Not precisely my question, though," Gaius said. "How far have we come in total? I've been a tad distracted myself."
Amara settled down on the ground beside him, the better to keep their murmured words as quiet as possible.
"Let me think. It has been 9 days since we set forth, of which we have been on the move for a little more than 7.
She mused over the terrain they had passed, adding the figures in her head.
"Somewhere between 130 and 140 miles, sire, or so I should judge."
Gaius blew out a breath.
"I confess I thought we would make much better time."
"We're past some of the more difficult terrain," she said. "From here the hills should become considerably gentler until we reach the swamps."
She scratched her nose and waved away a buzzing midge.
"Call it another 6 or 7 days to the swamps. Then our pace will slow dramatically."
Gaius nodded.
"The last 30 or 40 miles will be the hardest."
Amara glanced down at his foot.
"Yes."
Gaius caught the direction of her gaze and arched an eyebrow. Amara felt her face flush.
"Meaning no criticism, sire."
"I doubt you could give me more than I have already given myself," Gaius said, his tone light. His eyes, though, darkened a few shades, and his hands tightened into fists. "Hiding from a few squads of searchers, running until the Count has half-killed himself with effort. If we were close enough to Kalare by the great Furies, I'd..."
He cut himself off and shook his head sharply.
"But that's not yet, is it?"
"No, sire," Amara said quietly. "Not yet. But we'll get you through."
Gaius was silent for a long moment. When he spoke, his voice was weary.
"Yes. I expect you will."
Amara frowned at him.
"Sire?"
He shook his head.
"It isn't that time yet, either."
Something in his tone alarmed her, and she felt her frown deepen. "I don't understand."
"That's as it must be for the present," he said,
and leaned his head back against the wall of the ravine.
"Rest for a bit. We should try to rouse Count Calderon before long, cover more ground before nightfall."
"Are you sure you're ready for that, sire?"
"I'd better be, Countess," murmured the First Lord, and closed his eyes. "I'd better be."
Chapter 23 Tavi spent an eternity in misery, longing for death to bring sweet release from the unrelenting torment. The others gathered at the side of his bunk on the ship, keeping a death watch over him.
"I don't see what all the drama is about," Deimos said, his quiet voice filled with habitual disinterest. "He's seasick. It will pass."
Tavi groaned, rolled onto his side, and convulsed. There was little but tepid water in his belly, but he tried to get most of it into the bucket anyway. Kitai held him steady until the heaves passed, and regarded Deimos, Tavi, and the bucket with more or less equal distaste. Deimos frowned at the bucket and Tavi.
"Though I worry about the water stores, the way he's going through them."
He leaned down to address Tavi directly.
"I don't suppose it would be possible for you to get this back down again. It would conserve our..."
Tavi threw up again. Deimos sighed, shook his head, and said,
"It will pass. Eventually."
"What if it doesn't?" Tavi heard his mother demand.
"I wouldn't worry," Deimos said. "It's hardly ever fatal."
The captain nodded politely to them and departed the low-beamed cabin.
"Lady Isana?"
Kitai asked. Tavi thought that her own voice sounded strained.
"Is there nothing your watercraft can do?"
"Not without interfering with the Slive's witchmen," Araris said quietly.
"I do not understand," Kitai said.
"They're watercrafters, Kitai," Aaron said from the bunk above Tavi's.
Tavi heard paper rustle as the young cursor flipped a page in his book.
"They're necessary to any deep-water ship, to prevent a leviathan from sensing us."
"Leviathan," Kitai said.
"Like the thing that came to feed on Offal and Karnim at the Elenarch?"
"That one was only 40 or 50 feet long," Aaron said. "A baby, as they go. An adult leviathan, even a fairly small one, would smash this ship to driftwood."
"Why would it do such a thing?" Kitai asked.
"They're territorial," the cursor replied. "They'll attack any vessel that sails into the waters they claim."
"And these witchmen prevent that?"
"They prevent the leviathans from noticing the ship," Aaron said. "Of course, if a good storm kicks up, sometimes the leviathans find the ship anyway."
After a meditative pause, he added,
"Sailing is sort of dangerous."
Kitai growled.
"Then could we not put into shore where the water is too shallow to permit these beasts to approach and allow the lady to attempt a healing?"
"No,"
Tavi managed to growl. "No time to waste on pampering my stomach."
He broke off before he could finish the word and heaved again. Kitai supported him until he was finished, then pressed a flask of water to his lips. Tavi drank, though it seemed pointless. The water would barely have time to get into his belly before he'd be losing it again. His stomach muscles burned with constant fatigue and throbbed with pain. Tavi looked up to find his mother looking down on him, her expression gentle and concerned.
"Perhaps you shouldn't talk of such things here," she said.
"As long as we keep our voices down, it shouldn't be an issue, Steadholder," Aaron said. "We're at sea. The salt spray makes it all but impossible to work with air furies. Anyone who wants to eavesdrop will have to do it physically."
"He's right," Araris said in a quiet voice. "And don't pay any attention to Deimos's sense of humor, Isana. As long as we can keep getting a little water into the captain here, he'll be fine. He'll adjust to the sea eventually."
Kitai made a sound of disapproval that was not quite offensively rude. She had considerably refined her manners during her time in Alera, Tavi thought, but even so the lingering fatigue of having her arm crafted whole again, plus her concern for him, was wearing on her more and more heavily.
"When?"
Isana asked quietly. "We've been at sea for 4 days. How long will it take?"
"As long as it takes," Araris said, his voice patient.
Tavi heard the singulare rise and move toward the cabin's door. He paused to put a reassuring hand on Kitai's shoulder. When Tavi opened his eyes to look up at him, Araris gave him one of his brief, rare smiles.
"For what it's worth, I knew another man who was a bad sailor once."
Tavi felt his mouth twitch, but that was as close as he could get to smiling back.
"I'm going to get some sleep now," Araris said. "I'll sit with him tonight."
Kitai glowered up at the singulare as if she would object, but she did not. Tavi supposed that after 4 sleepless days at his side, the bags beneath her eyes had finally begun to outweigh her pride. Tavi spent the rest of the day fighting his rolling stomach and giving considerable thought to blissfully brief suicide. He drifted into a sleep broken by disorienting dreams and waves of particularly acute nausea. By the time the daylight had begun to fade, Kitai lay curled up on the lower half of his bunk, sound asleep. With Araris's help, Tavi staggered out onto the deck once night had fallen. Most of the crew sought their bunks and hammocks after the sun set, and only a few remained on deck. Tavi stretched out at the base of the mainmast, where he hoped the rocking of the ship would be least felt. He watched as the stars began to appear on a fine, clear night, and dropped into a true sleep for the first time in days. When he awoke, the first thing he noticed was a small but steadily growing pang of hunger in his belly. The night had grown pleasantly chill, though no less clear, and when he sat up he was nearly dizzied by a startling lack of disorientation. His nausea had faded to a faint echo of itself. He stood up slowly and stretched.
"Try to focus on the stars, or else the horizon," said a soft voice at the side of the ship. "It can help, sometimes."
Tavi padded over the deck and stood at the rail with Araris. The singulare stared out at the water, his eyes focused into the distance, and Tavi was content to stand beside him in silence for a long while. The sea rushed against the ship, a constant murmur, and their passage left trails of luminescence in their wake. Tavi turned his face into the breeze, tried to ignore the sore muscles of his stomach, and savored the absence of illness.
Araris broke the silence. "Have you talked to her yet?"
"Not really," Tavi replied. "Hasn't been time."
"She loves you."
"Very much."
"I know,"
Tavi said quietly.
"But that doesn't make it any easier," Araris supplied.
Tavi nodded.
"Do you understand why we did what we did?"
He nodded again.
"That doesn't make it much easier either."
Araris stared out at the waters. Then he pushed away from the railing and padded away. He returned and offered Tavi a flat, rectangular piece of what looked something like very dry bread.
"Ship's crackers," he supplied. "Good for a sour stomach."
Tavi nodded his thanks and gnawed at a corner of the bread. He'd broken stones softer than the stuff, but with enough work he managed to get a few gravelly bits to break off, and they softened in his mouth as he chewed. They tasted a little stale, but his stomach began to feel steadier after only a few mouthfuls. Between bites, Tavi asked,
"What was he like?"
Araris's head turned toward him in the darkness. Tavi could see nothing of his expression, only a glitter from his eyes. Araris stared at him for a time, then turned his face back to the sea.
"Arrogant," he said finally. "Impatient. Short-tempered." His teeth gleamed. "And compassionate, intelligent, generous, fearless." Araris sighed. "Too much so."
Tavi said nothing, waiting.
"Septimus was never satisfied with things the way they were. Everywhere he went and everything he did, he tried to leave a place better than when he found it. When he saw injustice, he worked to set it right. When he found victims, he offered them succor, then he avenged them. If he sank his teeth into an argument, he'd hold on until he'd won it or it died. I never saw him speak an unkind word to a child, strike a dog, or take spurs to his horse. When he fought,
It was like a thunderstorm going to war, and I never saw his better with a blade. We would have taken a spear in the heart for him. We, his singulares. We all thought he would become a great First Lord, as great as the original.